Coming up next hour, John Jensen, the founder of AncientCanalBuilders.com, will be here. But for the next hour, we have the one and only Bud Hopkins, premier UFO abduction researcher, author, investigator, and artist. And as I mentioned at the top of the program earlier, that a lot of his colleagues have sent in comments to be used on a special Bud Hopkins tribute page on our website, Coast to Coast AM. Including John Schussler, the former head of MUFON, who said, Bud has been a godsend to all the individuals that were alone and afraid because of their UFO-related experiences. From young children to the elderly, all experiencers, abductees, missing time victims, or whatever you want to call them, Bud treats each with compassion and heartfelt concern. Even when attacked by the so-called skeptics, he remained true to his mission, helping others. Bud is a superhero in this field. And Stan Friedman, our friend, who said, Bud has, in my opinion, done more to get people involved in abduction research and to take the subject seriously than anybody else. He made it okay to consider the subject and has brought a number of people out of the closet. Hopefully, more professionals in the field of psychology and psychiatry will pick up the torch. We'll come back in just a moment and resume our conversation with Bud Hopkins about some of the most important cases he's ever investigated. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Bud Hopkins, this is not one of your cases, but I've always wanted to get your opinion on it, and that's the Travis Walton case. It was made into a movie called Fire in the Sky. I met Travis Walton, found him to be a very credible guy. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. He's one of the most credible people one can imagine, and that's a terrific case. And his writing is extremely good about his experiences. But one thing that should be mentioned is that Tracy Torme, Mel Torme's son, wrote the screenplay for Intruders, and he was then hired to write the screenplay for Fire in the Sky. Obviously he was trying to get the abduction scene inside the craft and so on to be accurate. But the producers or the powers that be told him, no, it's got to be completely different than Intruders. You can't seem to have the same looking aliens and the same procedures because it wouldn't be interesting to people. You've got to write a whole new abduction scene. So poor Tracy had to sit down and invent the entire onboard experience that appears in the movie. And Travis always was upset about that because he wanted authenticity. And he seems in the movie, as I recall, like he's floating around inside a giant intestine of something. I don't know what, but the point is, it's that part was totally off. To find out what really happened, you can check out his books. He had two versions of the books about his experience, but it's an excellent case because it's part of it is witnessed by six other people. They passed polygraph tests. The whole thing really holds together. It's one of the key cases. And what's interesting is, of course, all the men were in the truck coming back from their job of clearing brush and driving along when they saw this craft and the whole thing unfolded. And yet you can have somebody like Susan Clancy, who is to science of, you know, what, I don't know, I don't know what to say, that's also not actionable, but she is the big skeptic on the subject, and she says the whole thing is sleep paralysis, six people driving along in a truck.
Everybody went to sleep at the same time, I guess, huh?
I guess they did, yeah.
Well, you've faced that a number of times. We talked about ufology. I want to talk about science or lack thereof. There was a program on NOVA, which is supposedly a really good science program, and I've seen some great episodes, but they had Kidnapped by UFOs was the title of this program, and they produced it basically at your expense, right? I mean, they took great liberties with the facts of the cases.
Well, it was unbelievable because in that case, the family who lived in Florida had various members of the family, young family, had had abduction experiences. And the husband, who agreed to go on camera, showed the camera people, and I'm standing there for all of this, where he was lying when he somehow was paralyzed and fell, and was against the wall. From the other side of the wall was his bedroom. He was trying frantically to move, to bang on the wall or something to get his wife alerted to what was happening, because as he was lying there, straddled by two or three aliens in different positions, he could see his little boy being floated out of the house at the end of the hall by other aliens. And he was very emotional about this. All of that was cut. They refused to put any of it in the film because their whole thing was to say this was sleep paralysis and or whatever they had in mind. But it was the way the thing was edited was just horrendous.
So basically, they went into this production with an idea how it was going to end up. This wasn't an investigation. It was a scripted program. They knew they were going to trash the research from the get-go.
Exactly. That was the worst experience I've ever had with television. I've had a lot of bad ones. I've had a lot of good ones, but the bad ones, this one is the top of the list.
And what do you make of that, Bud? I mean, how can they call themselves a science program and do something like that? How do you ethically juggle the facts like that and still call it science?
Well, I think that they can call anything science if they want to. But the basic thing that happens here, excuse me, is that they start off with the assumption there's nothing to this. So they shoot a lot of footage, and the footage that tends to support the reality of the experience, like the footage I just described, that's all cut. And anything that they can get in there that's sort of irrelevant or whatever, or that they can somehow warp, they will leave that in. It's a cherry-picking process that's totally, absolutely dishonest. It was the most dishonest piece of television I've ever seen.
Let's talk about maybe the centerpiece case that you have worked on. You wrote about it in a book called Witnessed. It's Linda Cortile, Linda Napolitano. It's the case that involved the Secretary General of the United Nations. I know it's a long and drawn out story. Can you capsulize it? And then I want to ask you a couple of questions about it.
Well, I've never said outright publicly who the third man was, an important person. The press has picked up the name you just mentioned, or the rank, but I've never confirmed or denied anything about it. That case is so complicated. It has so many different witnesses to it. But in essence, Linda was somebody I'd been working with for about a year off and on because of her early experiences. And she called me one day to say something had happened the night before, and she remembered going out the window. And anyway, when we looked into this, what had happened is that she had floated out in very brilliant light and was then lifted up into the UFO. There were three little aliens with her. Now, that was where the thing sort of was left, and actually only part of that emerged under hypnosis. But I got a letter from two men who presented themselves as police officers who had seen this happen, witnessed it. And as I tried to deal with them and tried to locate them, they did not want to come forward, but they did come forward to her and actually frightened her. The whole thing is extremely...
They snatched her, right? They kidnapped her.
Complex. But ultimately, it turned out they were security people, and they were guarding an important individual who, along with a number of other people in this procession of cars, evidently witnessed what happened. I found witnesses. I was approached by a witness who saw the whole thing when, from her position on the Brooklyn Bridge. There was a witness down below on the FDR Drive. I mean, the whole thing is just rife with witnesses and testimony. And it's important, I think, to realize that this happened, excuse me, in 1989. It's a lot of years, over 20 years ago. And there were about 20 witnesses to one or another part of this whole thing. And all of them have stuck by their accounts, absolutely, as in the Travis Walton case. It's very, very hard for the skeptics when you have so many witnesses who would have to call it a hoax to call the hoax of 20 years later or much later than that with the Travis Walton case. No one has come forward, including children, to change their story. But it's a great case. I said in my book that in my memoir that the book witnessed on that case was in a way the closest to my heart because there was so much information that had to be controlled and put down. Even now, it's hard for me to remember exactly whether this happened before that or whether these two people were there or there were three, that kind of thing. But it's a major case.
But this, you know, the main events are in 89, but it continued to dribble in new information for for years, right?
Yeah. New witnesses turned up. Of course, one of the problems is witnesses who turn up after the book has been published
right.
are already have a couple strikes against them. But, you know, I felt certainly in one of the witnesses that it was a very genuine, he was a genuine witness. And the second was certainly a genuine witness to the stopped motorcade.
I understand that you're being circumspect about the important man who was in a car down below and saw some of this stuff happening. I will just say that other writers have identified this person as a Secretary General of the United Nations, and other writers have said that the two men who were with him were not just security guys, they were agents of a U.S. agency, an intelligence agency, who subsequently communicated with you about this very perplexing experience. And I'm not asking you to confirm what agency they work for or who that guy is. What I would ask you is, did they see it on purpose? And this is speculation on your part. Were they supposed to see it? Was the main guy?
The basic point, I think, because of all of the bright lights. See, first of all, we got abductions in all the major cities of the world, practically, which are not witnessed, not seen. So how does the thing get, the museum tower next to the Museum of Modern Art, I had some people taken from something like the 22nd floor. Now, it's New York City in Midtown, but these things are done in such a way that they're unseeable. But in this case, this particular case, all the lights were turned on, and actually a couple of the witnesses told me that they thought they were watching a movie being made, a sci-fi movie, because of the lights were so bright. This was an attention-getting thing. And the motorcade, which had this important person and others, other important people, was deliberately stopped where it would have a perfect view. So this was kind of a showing off. This is as close as we get to the fabled idea of the landing of the White House lawn. And the whole thing took place in maybe 2 or 3 minutes.
So it's as if they can do this. They have ways, and you got into the study of invisibility, things of that sort, the physics of that sort of thing later, and we can talk about that. But there are ways that they can disguise this if they want to.
Absolutely.
When they make it obvious, when they make it obvious and allow people to see it, multiple witnesses, 20 witnesses, it's because they want to be seen. It's a display of sorts.
Yeah, well, actually, there were far more than 20 witnesses, but that I'm talking about whoever has come forward that I've been able to contact.
Right, right.
But how many are there out there tossing and turning at night thinking, what the hell is going on in this world?
But the idea that that whoever is doing this wants to be seen once in a while for whatever reason. How have you thought about what the reason is there? Why sometimes they do and sometimes they don't?
Well, that's one of the biggest mysteries of the whole phenomenon. How come they can be seen sometimes and not seen other times, be apparently invisible and sometimes seen? And we have the weird situation of them being invisible and yet being traceable on radar, even though the human eye cannot pick them up. What's going on here? Why isn't it one pattern? Why would they show off at one point and hide at another? The hiding is, of course, the biggest part of this. I mean, the abductions, witnessed abductions are extremely rare, and abductions are extremely common as experiences. So it would seem that there, most of the appearances really are invisible. Appearance is the wrong word. Incidentally, I should apologize for my voice. On top of everything, I've had a kind of chronic bronchitis, so my voice has gone from its normal baritone up to a high, thin, reedy tenor, which I'm embarrassed about, but it's the best I can do.
Well, it sounds good to me, Bud, and I hope to squeeze every drop out of you here. If you can hang on with us until the top of the hour, we're enjoying it very much. We talked in general about science, about your experiences with television and science television. What about scientists themselves? You mentioned Susan Clancy, who has sort of sprung toward the top of the heap of debunkers for this field out of the blue in the last couple of years. Have you had personal interaction with her, and what, if so, what's that been like?
Well, she and I both spoke very briefly. I think we had 10 minutes each at the American Psychological Association meeting in Boston. And the thing is, she preceded me, and she sort of so flummoxed me. She described the Hill case as, well, these people were driving along at night and they saw some light, and they pulled their car off the road, and they thought the light was moving, and then later on they did hypnosis and out came an abduction because they had seen something on television. And there was absolutely nothing about the fact that the Hills had seen the object fairly close, and through binoculars they could see the aliens looking through windows at them. And so all of that, all conscious memory, she skipped to make it sound like there was nothing to it. And then when I started talking talking about my experiences and the fact that she had this very, very small sample of people she was working with trying to establish that they all have sleep paralysis, I said that we must have had a different sample, I said, because this has never come up. And she said, oh no, I had some of your people in my sample. Well, that happened to be a lie. What she was thinking of is she had some of John Mack's people in her sample, but no one that I ever worked with. And I was so disturbed and confused that I hope I made sense. I was showing basically slides of physical marks on people, and scoop marks and straight line cuts, and the damage on the ground and so forth to provide physical evidence that has nothing to do with sleep, anything.
Well, I suspect it's a lot easier in 10 minutes to muddy the waters than it is to make a persuasive case. Our conversation with one and only Bud Hopkins continues after this on Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for being with us, everyone, tonight. We're talking with the one and only Bud Hopkins, author, artist, investigator, who has been called by another of our tribute senders here, Peter Davenport of the National UFO Reporting Center. Bud Hopkins' work in abduction research isn't just a cornerstone of ufology, it's a foundation. I expect that one day, because of his immense contribution to ufology, Bud's name will appear next to those of the great scientific pioneers of all time. Not sure if Bud would agree with that, but when we come back, we'll have our final comments and questions for him. And then at the top of the hour, we'll be talking with John Jensen of ancientcanalbuilders.com. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. I have in my hands a copy, a tattered paperback copy of Missing Time, the book by Bud Hopkins, written, I think, in 1981. This one is signed, Bud, by you here in Las Vegas, September 1991. And there's a section in there I wanted to read for you. It's toward the end where you talk about what can be done. That's the title of the chapter. And you wrote back then, the efforts of the many individuals and organizations throughout the world to investigate and record the UFO phenomenon and all its complexity are, despite the best intentions, inadequate. What's needed now is an official government effort, an agency whose purpose would be fourfold. And then you tell about what the four purposes would be. One, including an obligation to prepare the public for the day when the alien presence is obvious to everyone. From this vantage point now, 29 years later, does it seem naive to believe that that could ever happen?
Well, it was also new to me back in 81 that actually the book was written in 80, so it was 30 years ago. It was so new to me that I was being hopeful and trying to sort out what I was discovering. Perhaps it was, in retrospect, naive of me to think that something like that might happen. But if it's going to happen, it's going to happen a different way. It's going to happen, I think, the way Leslie Kane has set it up, that we're only dealing with, the investigation will only deal with these objects that are flying around. And the whole notion of the pilots, the crew, the aliens themselves has to be left for to emerge from the investigation, but not be the subject of it. And obviously, that's going to be the same problem with the abduction phenomenon. But the point is, in the meantime, there's no reason why people in the mental health community can't get together and begin to look into this in a serious way. And of course, quite a few of them have. Oddly enough, I've worked with 8 people. One I didn't work with very much, but 7 and then this other man, who were psychiatrists, who were also abductees. And I've worked with a number of psychologists and psychotherapists who were abductees. And I've been trying to, of course, get them to do this sort of work. But the problem for them is that if they're advertised as accepting the idea of alien abduction, maybe their list of clients and patients is going to drop. I can understand their worry. That's the problem with the whole notion of ridicule that has been officially brought on this subject by the government.
That's why I could never imagine a government-sanctioned program. I mean, it would make sense, of course, for, as you mentioned about Leslie Kane's approach of small bite-sized pieces, it would make sense for the government to find out what is intruding in our airspace, what is detected on our radar, what interferes with our missile control systems, things of that sort. But it just seems to be a paranoia that would just not allow them to take that step, even though it makes perfect sense to do so.
Exactly. It's the whole issue of this being so disturbing and so potentially scary and so damaging to somebody's to conventional wisdom in any of these fields, psychiatry or physical sciences and so on, means that people just stay away from it. And even though, as you say, it's absolutely the most logical thing in the world to do. And we did have, of course, with Project Blue Book and Alan Hynek's supervision there, we did have something going. until they decided to do the Condon report and drop the whole subject.
I am generally pessimistic, but, you know, you look at the broad picture of what's happened in our lifetimes in this research, and there was a time when even in ufology, the UFO researchers didn't want to talk about aliens. They were comfortable saying that these are ships and spaceships from somewhere else, some other planet, but they were very uncomfortable in talking about the possibility there were aliens inside, let alone that aliens were abducting people. So at least ufologists have come a long way. Maybe yeah. The answer in the future, we will not have a government-sanctioned program, but if you're looking for a silver lining, maybe it could be something on the scale of what you described, that professionals, psychiatrists, psychologists, privately, on a small scale, take these cases seriously and try to help people through these traumatic experiences.
Well, it's certainly would seem possible that something like that could happen, and I felt, of course, that I've been successful in bringing some mental health professionals into this. Most famously, of course, John Mack, but a number of others, and I think there are a number of people who are working sort of secretly without announcing that they accept the reality of this, but they are taking clients, taking patients, and helping them out. But as a matter of fact, I just received a referral from someone who I knew many years ago who was skeptical. This was a psychologist. And she sent me a referral. Somebody came to her with all of the earmarks of being an abductee, and she wasn't sure what to do. So she's sending this person on to me. It's a New Yorker anyway, so.
We touched on it briefly earlier about the ultimate direction that this phenomena is taking, and you are not optimistic. I mean, there are dark sides to this that you have discussed, that David Jacobs has discussed, that the ultimate truth is not going to be something that maybe humanity is ready to hear or that we'll have a happy ending where we all walk off into the sunset holding hands.
That's certainly true. I would like to end the movies about the phenomenon that way, with people walking hand in hand into the sunset, but I'm afraid that's not the way it's going to be. I mean, it's the whole thing is a lot more ominous than I allow myself to think when my thoughts go in that direction. So it's a very, very difficult thing to face, especially when I think of my little granddaughter and all the rest of us. It doesn't look in any way optimistic. There's no way that you can find to say they have done good, they have helped, they have done all of these good things that we would like to, what that we used to hear from the so-called contactees and so on. There's no sign of that, and that's one of the most depressing things. I've said many times that during World War II, UFOs were very present, and I have a number of abductions from the 30s and even a couple from the 20s. But if they were flying around and doing their stuff, they didn't bother to save, one Jewish child from Auschwitz.
Does it? Do you foresee, and I don't know how much detail you want to get into, but do you see a time when there's some dramatic revelation that there is a landing, that they appear suddenly in the sky over major cities, or would your guess be that they continue to sort of pluck out individuals at will and do with us what they will, like cattle going to a slaughterhouse, or maybe not that dramatic, but
there's much talk about quote unquote the word disclosure, which is one of my more hated words right now, as if it's all going to be very clear and the government's going to announce and they're going to land and it'll all be going into the sunset hand in hand or something. There are people, believe it or not, teaching courses in how to deal with the aliens when they arrive. if you can imagine collecting money for a course like that. But the point is that as far as I'm concerned, what I think is going to happen is more and more people, because this is, I mean, it really is happening, more and more people are becoming aware of the whole phenomenon in its many branches. And whether they're abductees themselves or no abductees, or that it's an issue of a sighting that's just beyond belief to them and so forth, whatever, more and more people are accepting the reality of this. So it's going to come from the ground up, from the people up, until perhaps the government decides that things are getting out of control and they've got to make some sort of statement, although I don't know what that statement would be.
Yeah, I mean, what do we do about it?
Exactly the point. What can they do? And this is, I mean, the cards are all in the hands of the UFO occupants. I keep hoping that maybe we discover something like that scene in The Wizard of Oz when a bucket of water makes the witch melt, you know? Something as simple as that. You toss a bucket of water on an alien and it melts away. We've discovered that we have some sort of defense, but I don't see that happening. And, you know, we're so much under their control when they want us to be under their control that it's a foregone conclusion that this is not some sort of competition we're going to win.
You know, Dr. Jacobs, and I don't want to keep coming back to him without him being here, but he has written some stuff about aliens being among us, that these other intruders, whatever the heck they are, walk among us, that hybrids walk among us, that they interact with us without our knowledge. Do you go that far?
Well, I wrote about such things in Sight Unseen, and I also have encountered situations like that going way back into the early 80s. So I've always been aware of this, but I didn't really make much of it for the reason that I didn't want to lose my audience and have people say, well, this man is completely over the hill here with this crazy stuff. I slipped it in here and there in various books, but I didn't go into it in any detail. Dave has been much braver than I and has gone into it in much more detail, but I do think such a phenomenon is taking place that there are hybrid beings that look like us, but apparently have the alien skills and psychological ability to control us and so forth. And I think that there are people like that among us. I've never actually met any, but that I know of, shall we say. But the point is that it certainly fits the patterns. And I think I've got enough sort of case material that as far as I'm concerned, it's a reality.
You mentioned at the very beginning of the interview that you've got new cases coming in all the time. Are there new wrinkles? I mean, as you said, you've established the basic pattern of what happens to people, the basic abduction kind of experience, that it happens all over the world to different kinds of people from different walks of life, day, night, multiple witnesses, happens to people alone. Are there new wrinkles, though, I guess separate from this aliens among us kind of a thing that you're noticing?
That's one hell of a wrinkle, I have to say.
Yeah, that's a big wrinkle, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm going to be starting work this week with a man here in New York who has had a lot of experiences, including waking up and when he was a young married man and they had a little girl who slept in the room with them. And he woke up in the middle of the night and saw about four or five aliens standing around her. She was sitting up in bed, and he was a black belt karate man. And just as he was getting ready to attack, he didn't know what they were. He said they looked frail. He figured he could take them easily. Instantly, he was paralyzed and fell back in the bed. But the the girl said in the morning when they got together and he was, they were having breakfast and he was still shaking because his memory, all this, it's all conscious memory. She said, "Daddy, who were those little people in the room last night?" And this man has his daughter is right, lives right near him in New York. But what I was getting to in a roundabout way, he mentioned something that has come up in some cases as a medical condition, which I would be very curious to hear from anybody, any of our listeners who had something like this happen. But this particular man who saw the little figures in the bedroom said when he was about seven, he started to, he realized he was urinating blood. And this was, I mean, he was having UFO experiences, which he remembered part of. But at any rate, urinating blood is a very, very dangerous condition. And something I went through and was told right away by the doctor, there are only two causes, either a severe bladder infection or a tumor. And in my case, it turned out to be a tumor, and I lost a kidney as a result to cancer. And so this little boy was taken to the hospital every single day for 30 days. There was no tumor that showed up, but they had to give him powerful antibiotics, which were extremely painful. But I have about three cases which involve this issue of blood in the urine. And this is a very serious medical condition. And I would like to hear from other people because it's something that's quite rare, but it is in a certain sense a new wrinkle.
And if people in our audience have had this experience or know something about it, they should contact the Intruders Foundation?
Absolutely. And the Intruders Foundation is going to be revived because of my illness. We've been very, very behind in everything, but we are going to be reviving our seminars. And whether I'm able to participate or not, and we're going to be continuing with investigations. And Jed, we have several people who are, one in particular, is doing hypnosis with us. And I'm leaving some kind of legacy here, I hope.
Well, I'm glad to hear that the work goes on.
Yes.
All the work, the valuable stuff you've done. Is this, one final question, and when the music starts, that's our sign to go, is it resolvable through science, through the prism of science, or is it something that we need to look at through a different kind of a prism or paradigm?
Well, I don't think there's any way, any paradigm, any prism that wouldn't be useful. I think the whole thing is, this is so complex a phenomenon that any way we can get at it is worth trying. It's very interesting to me that years ago, the nuts and bolts people did not like anything that seemed paranormal in a psychological way. They didn't like the idea of mental telepathy being involved, which, of course, it is in practically every single abduction. They didn't like that. And, of course, the people who were trying to turn this into something more spiritual didn't like the nuts and bolts thing and the people taking soil samples, etc. But you have to have both sides of the subject examined, and probably more will emerge as time goes on. But any tool that would seem to help should be employed. I mean, we're in a situation where we need every single thing we can get. And every person with good ideas.
You have to follow the evidence and the experiences where they lead. Bud Hopkins, always a treasure to talk to you. I hope you're around a long time and get to join us again.
Well, that may happen. Who knows?
And I hope you check out the tribute page on the Coast to Coast website. Thanks so much for being with us, and I hope to see you in person sometime soon.
Okay.
Bud Hopkins, all right. Good night, Bud. Bud Hopkins, our special guest. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. Coming up next, John Jensen to talk about ancientcanalbuilders.com, his website. Stay with us, everyone on Coast to Coast.